Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a science fiction book, I stick the review up here on the podcast feed. First of all, some news updates, or alternatively, as it normally becomes at the beginning of this, why Luke hasn't done any book reviews lately, because it's been about, 10, 15 days since the last book review. Well, as I mentioned in the last episode, in the video episode that I did, or the streaming episode that I did, I was going to read some non-science fiction books. So I read The Steel Remains by Richard Morgan, which is a fantasy book. I'm not going to be doing a podcast review of that because it's a fantasy book, even though there are some science fiction elements in it, but I will be taking part in a roundtable discussion about this book on the SFF audio podcast. With the guys from the SFF audio blog there, and that'll be out at the weekend, and I'll stick a link to it in the feed, so you should probably just get that, if you want to hear what we have to say, or specifically about some fantasy books, which I don't normally talk about too much. Also, another book that I've been reading is called The Bible with Sources Revealed. It's a new translation of, a recent translation of the first five books of the Bible, not a novel, so of course nothing to do with science fiction either, just my own reading there as well. Also, I've been writing my own book or novel for release as well. That's called Combat Story, working title, of course. It's coming along nicely. I'm only about 11,000 words into it so far, but it's going really well, I think. Also, I went to the British Juggling Convention over the past 5 or 6 days, and that was a lot of fun, which means, of course, I'm not reading while I'm there, doing anything. And finally, the biggest bit of news, of course, in my life is that I'm now single. Paula, my girlfriend, been together 4.5 years, and then she dumped me. Came as a bit of a shock, and it sort of put me out of action for about a week, I guess. But there you go. So, and thanks to the emails of people, because quite a few listeners here, they follow along on Twitter and on my blog, and I mentioned it there. So thanks to the emails and the commiserations, but I'm going to be all right. So anyway, what's happening now is that I've not done a review for quite a while, and I'm only about a third of the way through the book that I'm currently reading, which is Eiffelheim by Michael Flynn, and I'm enjoying that. But I thought what I'd do is, so I'm not leaving you guys or you listeners hanging too long, I thought I would talk about why I haven't finished another book that I started reading. So this is not going to be a review of a book, it's going to be me outlining the reasons why, despite some things in the book being mildly interesting, why I've decided that I'm not going to be finishing Last and First Men by Olaf Stapleton. So, I'll just get straight into that then. Last and First Men, written in 1930, or published in 1930, probably written it's quite a long book, so it probably took him quite a while to get through it as well. It's about 350 pages in the book. I started off reading it as a print book, as a real book, and then I downloaded it on from a website. I can't remember where it comes from now, or Fiction Wise or whatever it was from, on the free feeds there, and read it on my iPod for a bit as well. And I sort of picked it up again, but keep coming back to it, keep trying to get through it, but it just wasn't keeping me interested enough. It was always a slog to do it. So first of all, just as a bit of a compare contrast kind of thing, let me just tell you what I like about science fiction. What I really enjoy is that you change something about the laws of physics, or you change something in the level of technology, or you change history in some way, and then step two is what you do, you extrapolate that for a while into a series of events, or into a series of new ideas that come away from that sort of first tweak. And then what you do is you show how these events affect people, or how the sort of the ideas affect the people, and therefore the people affect the events and stuff like that. So it's a story about people. And people is the key word here, because it's possible to tell a story without mentioning the people involved, but it's hard to make it entertaining or interesting. And that's why, whenever we watch the news and stuff like that, you get people involved. They always say, here's the human angle to this, and you don't just go, here is the story. You always sort of interview someone who's had that story to them, or you go to the person who was there, or if nobody was there or it doesn't really affect anyone, then you go across to the expert and say, hey, something's landed on Mars, what does this mean? And then the expert goes, we've been waiting a long time for this. And actually, you're sort of there along with the scientists who are sort of watching the probe as it lands on Mars and stuff like that. So even if there's no human involved, it still becomes a human story. And this is my main criticism with Last and First Men, is that it's not a story, it's not a novel, because people are missing. it doesn't talk about people at all. It only talks about things and things. So let me just go into what the book is. It's actually like a, what happens is a few billion years in the future, the last man, the last human person, casts his mind back in time to the 20th century and takes control of a writer or tells his story to a writer. And then the writer tells the story of humanity from the early 20th century on. So we get a future history written by Olaf Stapleton, but actually written by the last man, the last human in the solar system. So it starts just after the First World War, and it talks about this kind of theme, you know, a bit about the, you know, the politics after the First World War and the League of Nations, and it talks about some more wars and then the peace and then some more wars and then a bit more peace, and then so this nation fights that nation and this nation is wiped out completely and this continent is devoid of human life and this one goes out, and then these other two nations, they do this thing, and they, you get told about some religions and then it's about some new technologies. However, all of this story, and I've only gone over the, like the first five chapters in that point, so yeah, of course I did read a lot more, but I'm not going to go into those later parts really too much, but this story is told from such a distance, literally billions of years into the future. Someone billions of years in the future is telling the story of what happened in the 20th century, that any kind of personal connection or emotional attachment or any kind of empathy or sympathy, you know, it's nothing's there at all. I mean, it's all just missing. I talk sometimes about like the different points of view in novels. You know, you talk about first person and third person limited, and also when it was Charles Stross, he did it in second person. But then there's like these things that I mentioned in the past few reviews with Stephen Donaldson, with The Real Story. He wrote in like this omniscient third person, so the narrator knows everything that's going on. You know, and the same with From the Earth to the Moon by Jules Verne. You know, it's like an unlimited omniscient third person viewpoint. But you still have a feeling that the writer is a human being, you know, the person actually telling the story. He knows what everyone's thinking. He knows all the events that are happening at all times. But, you know, he sort of, or I say he, but the narrator, this unknown narrator, somehow ties himself into and actually connects with the humans. Meanwhile, Last and First Men, sorry, it's written from this completely inhuman point of view. So it's completely removed. Individuals are completely, utterly irrelevant to the story. And the main sort of unit of storytelling, or the main unit of character, is the nation or the race, or the political entity. As an example, in the first few chapters, it talks about the French versus the English, and then there's the Americans versus the Russian, like the Oriental versus the Westerners, the Occidental races and stuff. And these whole races of people, you know, millions or billions of people at a time, are given a single defining characteristic, single defining personality trait. And then it's assumed that we know everything that we could possibly need to know about every single person of that race. So not only does this make for like really tedious storytelling, because you got nothing to connect to. It's sort of like, oh, and then the Americans did this, and then, oh, and France did this, and I'm like, yeah, but what's actually going on there? But it's really racist as well at the same time. It's like procedurally racist. You know, that's what I'm meaning, like when the act of assigning a simple character, you know, to an entire race, you know, is racist. I mean, there's no other way of looking at it, and it's simplistic and it's boring, and there's no point to it either, because you get these like anthropomorphized racial groups or nations, and they're described in relation to nothing. He literally just says, this is what future Americans will be like of the 21st century. This is the character of Americans. And you're going, why? And then he might give some hints as to why they think like that, but generally we're just told, this is how they think. And Russians think like this, Indians think like this, Chinese people think like this, Africans think like this. And again, if I don't really mind so much racial stereotypes when they're interesting or serve a point, you know, I can give it a pass. But here they don't. They're utterly shallow and utterly, you know, vapid ways of looking at it. Maybe vapid is not the right word there. But you just look at it and go, really, is that all you can bring out of an entire nation of people, is just to wrap them up in a few lines and then just move on? Which, contrasting that against the Jules Verne novel, From the Earth to the Moon, that I reviewed a few episodes ago, I mentioned that there's this passage. I think I actually mentioned, tied it back to this book as well, Last and First Men, but there's this passage where it talks about the different nations and how much they donate to the moonshot project, the large gun to fire people at the moon. And in itself, the passage doesn't really have a lot of bearing on the plot, not on the plot, but it does have quite a lot of say in the story and the world itself as well, you know, because, you know, it works in the same level of single stereotypes representing a whole nation, but he uses it as a device to show how the world would respond to the Americans going to the moon or not wanting them to go to the moon or something like that, just by saying, oh, these, you know, this country don't need this country don't need this much. And also, it's actually a really funny passage, you know, because he's a funny writer. And Olaf Stapleton has got this, you know, complete sense of humor bypass operation going on. He's literally got nothing to say except, like humor-wise or life-wise or anything like that. It's just the driest book I've probably ever read, or the driest book which is set up as some kind of fiction. I'm not entirely sure, but yeah, certainly really, really dry. Some individuals are mentioned in the book, but they serve no other purpose than to sort of accidentally instigate some course of action for the greater race or the greater nation or tribe or whatever's going on at the moment. So, you know, for example, it happens time and time again at the beginning part of the book. It's like two nations are sort of antagonistic towards each other, and then we're told that they go to war. And then we're told, ah, they went to war, but actually what sparked the war was this little thing between these two people, and then the press got hold of it and blew it up. But actually, what happens between those two people, it could have been any other thing. It's like the conflict was going to happen anyway, and it's like just really strange, you know. Like, the only thing that happens is like these monolithic, unchanging attitudes of the nations involved, and any conflict between them is like this monocausal. It's like A plus B equals C, therefore D, you know, and that's all you get. That's the, you know, it's just so, like, the storytelling, the level of storytelling is so shallow going from point to point, and that, again, it's just not interesting. And it's not just uninteresting, it's actually unrealistic, you know, because even now historians are going, okay, what's, you know, how did, well, you know, what are the causes of the Second Gulf War? And you're looking at it and going, wow, it could be this, it could be that, it could be this, it could be that. But people are still thinking of that about, like, the First World War and the Second World War. It's, you know, like, the people, you know, it's like he's just looked at the beginning of the First World War and said, okay, Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo, and it started off the thing between Serbia and, you know, and all these people going on, the Austro-Hungarians and the Russians and all the, and all, they all go together, and it was just that one it was just that one event, and it did accidentally start the First World War, and then he's just gone, ah, this is the model for all previous wars, but because it's never just about the incident. So, yeah, it's just this really strange thing, and it just continues on and on and on, this lifeless description of races, and then some wars, and then some other nations, and then a natural disaster here, and then some new technologies here, and it's all told in exactly the same way, you know. Here's the race that evolved a few thousand years later. Here are the characteristics of that race. You know, here are the, you know, the things that they believed, and here is that. And then it goes, ah, and why is this? Well, maybe I'll just give you one or two little explanations, but there's never any explaining going on. And when it is explaining, it's so dry and unrealistic and unbelievable. It's just really boring. And I can understand what the author, what Olaf Stapleton was going for here, because the book has scope, you know, and it's an epic piece of work, and it had never been written before. But just because something is epic and has a lot of scope doesn't make it, you know, correct or interesting or satisfying or enjoyable or even worthwhile to read. Or let alone write, you know, it's like you think, actually, why did he write this? Of course, he has his reasons. There is some. Let me move on, actually, to the normal things that I talk about in the reviews, because I've talked a bit about the story, or lack of it, and the characters, or lack of them. But the technology, there is actually some interesting technology in the book, and some ideas are interesting. None, though, are very believable at all. And even the ones that are believable are, like, dumped down into a situation which has nothing to do with what's there. You know, for example, we have pages and pages about a race of humans, you know, and we learn about their character and, like I say, on the religion and stuff like that, and then it suddenly goes, oh, and by the way, everyone flies around in monoplanes that are powered by electricity generated by coal. And I'm just like, what? Everyone? And it goes, yep, everyone from the age of 18, everyone learn how to pilot a plane, and then they all fly planes, and, you know, there's millions of planes in the air at one time, and I'm just like, right. And then it goes something like, oh, and they've never flown into space. And I'm like saying, okay, so it's a million years into the future, or thousands of years into the future. Every single person, every single adult in the world has flown a plane and flies in planes all the time. So nobody has been able to get into orbit, or nobody even thought about that. I'm just thinking, right. And then it suddenly throws in a line like, and then the beings of Mars watched the events unfold on Earth, and I'm suddenly like, what? What? There's aliens as well? And it just sort of like throws it in there, and you're thinking, wait a second, shouldn't you have mentioned that humans discovered life on Mars like a few thousand years previously in the story? But it just doesn't do that. It just goes, oh yeah, and the Martians are watching. And I'm just like, right, okay. So it's just all over the place. You know, like I say, unbelievable. And even the stuff that is believable, like life on Mars, is just thrown into the story in such a haphazard way that it becomes unbelievable, or it becomes even unnecessary in a way. You know, the whole sort of, I did like the sort of theme that came up about conserving energy, because they're like using up all of their power to fly and all of their power for transport, and they're going to run out of coal and run out of electricity and things. So I quite like that little bit there, but then you're just thinking, wow, these people are really stupid if all they want to do is fly more for religious purposes, because they think flying is going to, you know, get them more energy out of it. And it's just doesn't make any sense. Two more points about the technology that I wrote down here. One is that he's very, very, very conservative in his predictions. Like, he does go into it, you know, and you read later on about, you know, trips, you know, into space and, you know, terraforming other planets and things like that, which I don't really want to get into. But it's like, is it really going to take millions upon millions upon millions of years before we leave the surface of the Earth? It's like, no, probably not. Maybe it'll only take, like, 30 years after this book was written, and 40 years to get to the moon, you know, and he just seems to miss it a lot. And it's like, in thousands and thousands of years' time, it's still people are exploring the North Pole. I'm thinking, okay, what does he think we're going to be doing in the next few years, since like the first person has gone across the North Pole? It's like, what's going to happen then? Probably more people are going to go across the North Pole. But then it's spoken about in the, you know, later on in the book, is like, only, you know, one boat is in the North Pole, and when all the rest of humanity dies off, just that one boat of adventurers going across the North Pole survived. Which, again, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, considering, like, every person in the world had been flying before then. So you'd think, well, what's there to explore at the North Pole when people have been flying for the last few thousand years? It's like, why do they need that? And then it goes, oh yeah, and there's some navigators on the boat. I'm thinking, okay, if everyone has learned how to fly and everyone flies everywhere, would you still need professional navigators for a ship at sea and people to use the ship at sea? It's like, no, you probably wouldn't need all that, because we'd have, you know, if everyone was flying all that time, you know, maybe they'd have licked the whole navigation problem and things. So it's a very strange kind of thing. So it's very conservative and just wrong. And like I say, massive time scales to come up with things where, if it had just looked at the beginning of the 20th century when he worked out, like, okay, we invented flying objects, you know, heavier-than-air flight, like, less than 40 years ago, and look where we're up to now in the 1930s, you think, yeah, he could have moved on a lot quicker, you know, just extrapolating from that point. Second point is, that I didn't like about the technology, or one of the things that I didn't like about technology, is the old genie back into the bottle trick. It's like a solution to bad writing. Near the start, some unnamed scientists, although they sort of are named a little bit, but anyway, they invent something that can destroy the world. You know, they switch on and it starts destroying, and they switch off and it stops destroying. And if they left it, you know, if they leave it on, it will just keep destroying until everything's up, you know. And they actually use it once in the book, and then they go, oh, and we're never going to use this again. It's too powerful. We're never going to use it again. So then it's just dropped from the story. It does have some impact later on, you know, when they're going, okay, and these scientists are trying to rediscover this source of energy. But it's just, you can't do that. You can't just go, if, you know, like, let me put it this way. If a technology is needed for the story, you must deal with the consequences of that technology. That is like the key. That's like the backbone to science fiction, like good science fiction. You know, you can just discard it, you know, and just go, here's a technology, we don't need it anymore, we'll just ignore it from now on. But that's actually what you call bad science fiction, unsatisfying science fiction. You know, for example, there was the Red Thunder book by John Varley, and I said at the end of that, he makes this device which breaks like the second law of thermodynamics, but he just makes it way too powerful, because he just needs to get the kids to the to Mars really, really quickly. And his solution at the end of this book, which, because it's like he couldn't be bothered to work through all the ramifications of such a technology, just to go, ah, what we're going to do is make it so only 8 people on Earth know how to make one of these things, and then they control it, you know, and nobody can get hold of it apart from these 8 people who live on the Falkland Isles, and nothing ever bad happens after this, because nobody knows how to use it, and nobody knows how to make them and stuff like that. It's just like, are you sure? Are you sure nothing bad's going to happen, you know? You've got a device here which is literally more powerful than nuclear energy, and it's more power. It's like the most powerful force on Earth, and you're just going to make sure that only 8 people ever know how to make it? It's like, no, somebody else will come up with it. If it's possible, somebody else will come up with it. So it's one of these really weird things. It's just like, you know, it's like Star Trek. I've not seen many episodes, but it's often they go, ah, and to get out of this problem, we'll invent this. And I'm just like, yeah, but now you've invented that. That sort of negates everything that you've done before and after in the story. Anyway, seems to happen quite a few episodes, and in the film as well. You think, okay, you've got the time travel. I mean, I'm just talking about the latest Star Trek film, but you think, so if you want to avenge your wife, or if you don't want the planet to be killed, why don't you then go back in time and then stop it happening in the future, or go over and save the planet now rather than running? It's just these weird things. You just haven't thought that through, have you? So you're just going to forget about that element. And that's what happens in this book near the beginning. Anyway, moving on to the writing style. As I said, it's very, very dry and very, very dated. Like I say, no humour, no life, very drab, written in this sort of like inhuman style. You know, I say inhuman. It's obviously written in a human language, but it's written with no human characters or any kind of emotional connection. And I understand why he's doing it. I realize it's a feature of the book, or it's meant to be a feature of the book, because it's written from a 2 billion year gap. But you want some comments about what's going on, you know? Really, you want some kind of, you know, subjectivity rather than all objectivity in the book as well. And and there's this massive long introduction to the book and forwards of the book to say that it's a dense book and it's probably not going to be interesting and you should probably skip the first few chapters. I'm thinking, wow, if there's a book that's actually telling me to skip the first few chapters because I won't like them, I'm going, well, that's a bit strange. And but then I've read other books from the 1930s. Well, I've reviewed other books for this podcast from way before then, you know, H.G. Wells and Jules Verne, and, you know, they're both so accessible. The writing style is there and you can really read it, and you don't need a long forward explaining why it's so important. The book still stands up on its own, and you can just read it because it's still enjoyable, whereas this isn't. So don't even read it for, like, what's old science fiction-like kind of study, because the book isn't worth reading in that way. You might as well read the good science fiction from back in the day and the enjoyable and accessible science fiction from back in the day. Moving on to the themes. I think I've hit on quite a few themes already, but the main ones seem to be human individuality is overrated and inconsequential. That's what it says. And also, human stupidity will always triumph over sound minds. You know, maybe not sometimes. People are rational and, you know, and work things out and come up with solutions. But even then, you know, there's a story about like how the world is united in peace and it's got this, you know, world government and everyone's happy. But it's sort of overwhelmed. You know, the main theme of that story is how stupid people can be and how short-sighted people can be and how selfish people can be at the same time. And I'm just thinking, well, I actually think I have a little bit better view of humanity than is represented in this book. And also one of the final themes is that, you know, you're reading the book and you're just like, wow, the world really doesn't care about us, does it? You know, it's sort of like we'll just carry on and civilization will fall and then it'll come back again and evolution will continue. But again, the evolution kind of stuff is like, it's sort of thought out a bit, you know, where he talks about, oh, this is how they evolve. And it's just like, yeah, and they get a bigger head. And it's like, well, why do they get a big head? Or what's the evolutionary pressure to give them a bigger head? And it's never thought about. Whereas a book like The Time Machine, which is also, he goes way into the future and sees how humanity is going to evolve. All of the things, all of the directions and what happens to humanity in the future, and why they spread out, and, you know, just that saying, oh, and lots of other, most of the other animals, large mammals in the entire world die off, so then, of course, humanity becomes, you know, fills those roles in the future. Yes, you've got something to say about evolution, whereas this book just suddenly goes, oh, and evolution happened, and suddenly their hair was red, and I'm like, great, very well done there. Anyway, I think that's, I don't really have a lot else to say about this book itself, you know, except a little bit about sort of like the influence of this book, because it obviously is a very influential book for the world of science fiction and other science fiction writers. It is packed with ideas. There's loads of ideas. You know, it goes on about, you know, like I say, energy resources and religion and all these different things, you know, and it talks about, you know, trips across to Venus. And they started to, I didn't get past that point there, because it was just, you know, the sort of the brutality there with no comment on it was a bit strange. But I do know that it has, you know, it has gone on, you know, to influence other writers. But the thing is, the writers and the technology that it talked about, you know, and that it is inspired, you know, in other people's writers, are better writers than Olaf Stapledon himself. You know, he influenced people who then repeated his job, or actually did his job properly. In other words, they talked about science and made it into fiction, and that then related it into a human level for people to actually read and enjoy, so it actually serves a purpose. You know, there's no point in just writing academic papers about possible futures of history and then going, oh, you can read this book, and everyone goes, oh, why should I read this book? And it's like, well, you should read it. And it's like, yeah, but why should I think about this? Why should I think about what you're trying to tell me? And then you go, well, you should just read it. And you go, well, why? Whereas someone like, say, Isaac Asimov with the Foundation series, he goes, okay, here's a story about a future thing, and I'm going to talk about politics, I'm talking about, you know, individual choice, I'm going to talk about all these different kind of things. And you go, why should I read this? He goes, well, of course you're going to read it. It's an entertaining story. And they go, oh, yeah, you're right, it is. You know, there's actually something there, and you can connect to people. You know, I think, personally, I think lots of people overrate the Foundation series, but there's a lot of stuff to think about in there. But the reason why it's worth thinking about it and reading it is because they're actually stories. You know, every step through the future humanity of the Foundation, you know, of the Foundation and the Empire and all that kind of stuff, you go through it through people. You meet the Mule, you meet the Colonel, you meet the, you know, you meet Harry Seldon himself and his students, and you meet the Emperor and all these different people that you meet, and they have some impact on the world, and you actually can care about them or not care about them. But again, that's the point. You can care about them because they actually exist as characters. Whereas in Last and First Men, there are no characters, which is really strange. Which is a real pity because, you know, you can tell stories over long periods of time. You know, there's lots of these sort of epic space opera kind of, you know, hard science fiction kind of stuff as well. You know, I know that Stephen Baxter often does that. He goes off and he tells a book and it ends up with, like, the last man in the universe. And he goes, oh, okay, you know, and because of quantum physics, whatever, he just, you know, it's all these different kinds of things. And he does extrapolate way into the future to the heat death of the universe. So it can be done and it can have a story and it can be interesting. Another book that I liked, which was written over many years, maybe 10,000 years, was Edward Rutherford's Sarum book. It's not a science fiction book, but it goes from, it tells a story of, you know, the area around Stonehenge. But it starts off cavemen, it goes to the, you know, the building of Stonehenge all the way through to the Second World War. You know, it's a thick book, chunky book, but it's interesting. And then, you know, there's others that do this as well. I just mentioned I'm reading a new recent translation of the Bible, and the first five books of the Bible, and Genesis is set over thousands of years. You know, it deals with people at every turn, that you get to, and it has relevance as well, because the Bible was written, you know, the nations around the Judah and Israel that the Bible is actually written about appear in the book, and it talks about the roots of these nations. You know, it talks about so instead of representing people with groups of people, instead of representing individual characters by saying, ah, and this is what this whole nation is like, he does it the other way around. He says, this whole nation is like this because of this story in the Bible. You know, I say he, that's what the Bible does. The writers of the Bible were doing that. They were saying, ah, and this tribe up to the north, this is why we don't like them. And they actually said, yeah, it's because of this person betrayed this person, and, you know, that kind of stuff in the way back there. And so there's actually seems to be a point to it. Whereas there's just not much point to this. It's like someone's gone, ah, okay, The Hobbit, great book. Lord of the Rings, great book. Okay, what's the story behind it? Ah, it's the Silmarillion, you know? So you go, great. But there's a reason why so many people read Lords of the Rings and The Hobbit and so few people read the Silmarillion. So what we've got in Last and First Men is like the Silmarillion without The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings to make the entire journey worthwhile, you know, because there's not a story, or there's not a single story, because it's really hard to do that over long periods of time, is to have like the characters at the beginning to face a problem and then overcome it at the end. That doesn't happen in this book. So you've got this cyclical nature. I said before that I was going to do this and recommend other books, of the similar types. It's like, if you like this, you'll also like this. Or if you don't like this, you might not like this and stuff like that. So go check out my review of the book called... Oh, quickly, I'm going to have to look it up here now on iTunes. Let me check it out. It's written by The Crucible of Time. It's sort of called. Let me type this. Crucible and I'd check out the John Brunner, The Crucible of Time. Right, it took me a long time. I reviewed that book, and that book is set over, you know, many millennia, many millions of years, and it does tell the story of sort of like rising and falling civilizations on a single planet in there, and there, you know, and how difficult it is to get to the stars and stuff, and how things, you know, rise and fall and all kind of stuff. But it's actually good. It's actually interesting, and you can read it and you can grasp it. So this stuff, this whole thing, has been done since Last and First Men, and it's been done better so many times. So that's all I can say, really, is that, you know, you get this uncaring narration of things that you don't care about, you know. It's just not sure. I mean, at any point in Last and First Men, you could just stop and go, wait a second. We're going to use this setting now to tell a whole story. This is going to be the setting for a story. And you can see what the whole world building that goes into, you know, modern science fiction, you can see it, the roots of that go back to a book like Last and First Men, because it's all about the world building. It's all about the history behind it. But there's not that, like, human story as you get in like, every other science fiction book, novel, actually a novel, I'm going to call it a novel. So Last and First Men, no purpose to the modern reader. It's done its work. It inspired lots of science fiction authors over the past 70, 80 years, but its work is done. You don't need to be inspired by this book if you want to write something. You can be inspired by the books that have come after this because they're just a lot better. So the only reason to read this book is if you're interested in Olaf Stapleton. And to be honest, I don't really find him that interesting because his political views are very strange and his philosophical views are very shallow and not very well set out. I mean, to be honest, he could probably set out his philosophical and political views a lot better if he wasn't also trying to tell the future history of the Earth and humanity. So if I was going to rate this book, I would give it 1 star, but I'm not even going to rate it. Because this wasn't a review, it was actually an explanation of why I've not finished the book and why I've not done a review yet. So when I do finish this book, I will give it a rating and I will review it properly, but I'm never going to get there. So this book will remain unrated because I do think it's one of those unrateable books. And it's one of those books that I started reading and I was really trying to get through it, and there were some things, but I actually wish now I'd never even bothered starting this book. Someone could have just said, oh no, just read the Wikipedia page. I've not read the Wikipedia page, but, you know, just say, just read the Wikipedia page, you know, it'll outline most of what it is, because you really don't get anything from the text itself, which is a pity. Or at least I didn't. Maybe I'm just missing everything. Maybe I'm just not intelligent enough. Maybe I'm not clever enough, but I think with the way I've explained my views on this book, I've hopefully shown that I am slightly intelligent, just from my reading and disliking of it. Anyway, next book, Eiffelheim by Michael Flynn. So far, so good. And then after that, I've got other books. But you can follow me on Goodreads or check out my Goodreads profile, which is goodreads.com/Luke Burridge, and you can see what books I have on my shelf. Or you can follow me on Twitter if you want to keep up with my other things, and on my blog where I post everything. I just need to make a new post because I recently posted up some new videos and things like that. Otherwise, you can email me, luke@juggler.net. Actually, I got some emails last week that I still have to reply to. Someone mentioned, hey, you've not done any female authors for a long time on the podcast. And that's true, actually, but I don't pick books based on gender. Generally, I just see what appeals to me at the time. But I'll see if I can sort of bump some female authors up the list. Someone else said, hey, you should read is it The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. So I think, yeah, I'll see if I can find that book because it looks quite interesting. And I've never read it, and it is one of those classics. So I'll check it out. So otherwise, you can find all these links on the blog and on the sfbrp.com on the feed there. And otherwise, yeah, I'll catch you next time.